This is a recording from CSIS. To help us improve our content, please take our short survey located at csis.org/survey. You could win an iTunes gift certificate.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. My name is Nick Sechaney. I'm the deputy director and fellow with the Japan chair here at CSIS. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this edition of the Japan Chair Forum. This event today is part of a series of discussions under the rubric of our Japan Policy Fellowship Program. In 2008, in collaboration with the Center for Global Partnership of the Japan Foundation, we established a fellowship program to give rising stars in the scholarly community an opportunity to spend some time in D.C., and develop networks with various experts to further the policy debate. And it's my pleasure to welcome Gene Park, who's an assistant professor of political science at Baruch College, the City University of New York, who is our sixth Japan Policy Fellow and has been with us here for the last couple of weeks, who will give a very timely discussion of Japan's budget politics, in specifically the fiscal investment and loan program. He will give an opening presentation, and then we will have a question and answer session, more of a discussion, I hope, and we will go till about 11:30. So without further ado, Professor Park, thanks very much.
Okay, there it is. How's that? Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you all for coming out today in this miserable weather. As advertised, I'll be talking about Japan's second budget. How governments pay for their policies is a fundamental challenge. Governments can raise taxes or they can finance spending through borrowing, but neither option is particularly appealing. The hard choices governments have to make has become particularly clear since the global economic downturn in 2008, as the tax revenue stream of many countries has contracted. With large deficits and economic stagnation, many governments are caught on the horns of a dilemma. Use deficit spending to stimulate the economy or focus on deficit reduction. We have to choose between battling recession and fighting the deficit. There are trade-offs between cutting spending, raising taxes, or letting budget deficits grow. And unfortunately, there are no easy solutions. While these extraordinary economic times have made the trade-off between the choices even starker, even during periods of economic growth, how governments finance their policies is always an ongoing political challenge. But what's often overlooked is that governments often attempt to find creative means for paying for their policies. Governments certainly rely on taxes, as well as social insurance contributions, to finance their budgets. But they can also rely on alternatives to the budget. In some cases, sources of finance that don't impose the same kind of direct costs on their citizens. Some oil-rich countries, for example, rely on oil revenues. And some countries manage large sovereign wealth funds. The same is true of Japan, which, as many observers of Japan have long noted, has relied on a massive state-run system, financial system, that's run in parallel with its formal budget. This system is known as the Fiscal Investment Loan Program, or FILP for short, or informally as Japan's second budget. At its peak, FILP drew on the equivalent of roughly $4 trillion U.S. dollars in funds, and its annual allocations reached about 80% of its formal general account budget. Japan's choice to harness and expand FILP, as I'll discuss today, has had very tremendous implications both for Japanese politics and the development of its public finance system, including creating a number of problems that are with Japan today. So let me give you a brief overview of today's presentation. There are four main parts. First, I want to give an overview of the FILP system, conceptually what it is, and also some of the mechanics of how it functions, with a specific emphasis on how it functioned until 2001. In 2001, there were important reforms that were introduced, but I'll discuss those later. Then I want to discuss the significance of FILP, excuse me, its larger policy and political meaning, how the government used it to manage its public finances, and what kind of political and policy challenges it allowed the government to resolve. Third, I'll talk about FILP reform, why it was needed in the first place, and also how the government went about reforming the system. And then finally, I'll conclude with a discussion of outstanding issues, issues that were not really addressed, in my opinion, by earlier iterations of reform, and some potential policy directions the government might consider as it moves forward. Okay, let me start with the overview of the FILP system. Now, the FILP system was established in 1953, and at the most general level, it can be thought of conceptually as a system for mobilizing savings for publicly directed investments and loans. Unlike the budget, FILP does not draw on taxes, but uses a financial mechanism, and this is important, to allocate credit and investment to achieve public policy goals. Of course, this is not unique to Japan. Governments around the world use such financial mechanisms to steer credit or investment to housing, small and medium-sized enterprises, public works projects, and so forth. I call this category of public finance policy finance. FILP is simply one example of a system of policy finance. Where Japan is distinctive, though, is in the scale of policy finance that it's mobilized and how it has used these funds. Now, this is a slide that shows Japan's heavy reliance on policy finance. And the figures here represent the outstanding loans, policy finance loans made as a share of GDP. And as you can see, Japan is very high. Okay, now let me talk about the structure of the FILP system and how it functioned. It's commonly thought of as having three component parts: an entrance, an intermediary, and an exit. Let me just show these all at once, at least until 2001. The entrance provides the funds for the FILP system. As you can see, there's postal savings and national pension reserves, and also below that, things such as kanpo, postal insurance, and other smaller sources of funds as well. I'm not going to talk about those in any detail just for the sake of brevity, but if you have questions, I'd be happy to talk about that in the Q&A. Postal savings, as most of you here probably know, is a large deposit program run out of the Postal Savings Bank, which is part of the post office. Depositors can make deposits into postal savings accounts, and the reserves are then transferred into the FILP system. The Postal Savings Bank, if it were a private bank, which it's now actually in the process of becoming, potentially, would be one of the largest banks in the world. National pension reserves is relatively more self-explanatory. Those are reserves from various public pension programs. These funds then were transferred until 2001 into the so-called intermediary of the FILP system. They were pooled together in this institution called the Trust Fund Bureau Fund, which was overseen by the Ministry of Finance, which then allocated those funds to the so-called exit of FILP, represented on the right side. And there were two primary types of exit institution: FILP agencies, which I'll discuss in a little more detail in a second, and local governments. Local governments financed a lot of local government debt via this fiscal investment loan program. FILP agencies, it's a very broad category, not one that's commonly used even by the media, refers to any number of public or quasi-public entities that use FILP funds. And there are two primary types of FILP agency. One is the public corporation, which typically invests directly in public projects, infrastructure projects such as roads and hospitals and so forth. And one of the best known examples is the former so-called Road Corporation, or more formally the Japan Highway Public Corporation, which Koizumi broke up and privatized. And as many of you know, in the 1990s, it became really a symbol of politicized pork barrel and wasteful spending, as well as corruption. Government financial institutions, by contrast, provide loans typically to the private sector, but also to public-private partnerships, as well as for public projects as well. They function more like banking institutions. One example would be the vaunted Japan Development Bank, or JDB, which was the symbol of Japan's supposedly forward-looking industrial policy that channeled capital to strategic sectors. Another example would be the National Finance Life Corporation, which was restructured in 2008, which was much larger than the JDB and provided funding for small and medium-sized enterprises, which have traditionally been a very large and powerful constituency politically in Japan, and one that's been traditionally aligned with the Liberal Democratic Party. Okay, there are a few points I want to emphasize about this FILP system. First is that in some ways it's similar to a budget. Each year, the Ministry of Finance, which also drafts the formal budget, drafts something called the FILP plan. And this FILP plan has the attributes of a budget. It specifies which of these exit institutions on the right will receive what level of funding for the coming fiscal year. And the process of drafting the FILP plan is one that takes place in parallel with that of drafting the formal budget. And there have been many points of contact between the two. The second aspect is that, unlike the budget, FILP does not rely on tax revenues and is in principle self-financing. The funds are lent from postal savings in these entrance institutions to the intermediary, which are lent to the exit, which then invests or lends them out yet again. But ultimately, the funds have to be returned back to the system, to the source of funds, because postal savings deposits obviously belong to depositors. National pension reserves have to be used to pay out future benefits, pension benefits. This is an important distinction. A third feature is that the fiscal investment loan program historically was very large and grew quite rapidly. And I'm going to show two slides that illustrate this. This is a slide that shows the size of the FILP plan over time, which was very, very rapid. Its growth was very rapid until the mid-1990s, when FILP was systematically targeted for reductions and reforms. And this is the size of the FILP plan in relation to the size of the general account budget, which went up from roughly around 30-35% of the size of the general account budget all the way up to nearly 80% of the size of the general account budget. Again, it drops off in the late 1990s. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about the significance of FILP. The significance of FILP stems from the fact that it doesn't rely on taxes, and thus it could be used as an alternative or at least a supplement to the tax-based budget. Now, why does this matter? It mattered tremendously because of the political and policy possibilities that it created. By serving as a supplement to the budget, it allowed the government to keep overall public spending high while keeping formal budget spending low. And this combination of policies was really critical to Japan's economic policy as well as the ruling Liberal Democratic Party's political strategy. Low budget spending was a pillar of the government's economic growth strategy, allowing the government to keep taxes low and budgets balanced through the 1970s. Balanced budgets prevented private sector crowding out, dampened inflationary pressures, and helped the government maintain its international balance of payments. Keeping taxes low encouraged private savings and private capital investment, which was the engine that planners expected to drive economic growth. This point's often been neglected by studies that emphasize the role of the state in industrial policy. FILP also allowed the government to square the circle politically as well. This is very important. Contrary to the view that Japan's fiscal or budgetary conservatism reflected the LDP's conservative social coalition or its ideological orientation, it was actually a policy that was deeply unpopular within the conservative camp and conflicted with the party's strategy of using generous public spending to stay in power. In fact, the origins of budget restraint can be traced back to the U.S. occupation of Japan, which imposed it on the Japanese government. Budget restraint, then, was a serious problem for the conservatives rather than any kind of policy or ideological preference. The Japanese government established and then deployed FILP, actually, as a means to overcome these externally imposed limits on budget spending. FILP not only helped finance the government's industrialization policies, but also kept the ruling party in power. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party used FILP to deliver generous material compensation to its supporters, and since FILP limited demands on tax revenue, it could also deliver popular cuts without running up deficits. Low taxes and high spending were critical to the LDP's political strategy. Now, the bargain that I just described, the fiscal bargain I just described, really stands in contrast to the experience of many other industrialized democracies. After World War II, governments increased taxes and budget spending, and in many cases employed Keynesian-inspired fiscal stimulus. The growth of the welfare state and Keynesianism are often said to be two pillars that helped reconcile the competing demands between democracy on the one hand and the market system on the other, and helped give rise to the so-called mixed economy. Now, Japan, by contrast, deliberately suppressed budget outlays and taxation as part of its distinctive economic strategy that I just described. In fact, in 1970, Japan had the lowest level of both as a share of GDP of all OECD countries. Both figures were well below 20% of GDP. Excuse me. By comparison, even the low-spending U.S. had budget spending and taxation that were well over 30% of GDP. Now, here's a slide that illustrates the impact of PhIL. Each of these dots represents individual OECD countries, and it's from 1970. There are two variables, two axes. The vertical axis is government outlays as a share of GDP. In other words, budget spending as a share of GDP. The bottom axis, which is a little hard to read, is public fixed capital investment as a share of GDP. And as you can see from the configuration of the position of each country, there's a strong correlation between both of these variables. And this isn't particularly surprising. As governments spend more, the amount going to public fixed capital investment, roads and infrastructure and so forth, also increases. Now, what I want to draw your attention to is the position of Japan, which is, as I mentioned before, was low taxing and low spending, at least in budgetary terms. That's indicated by its quite low position. But as you can see, it's quite far to the right. Its level of public fixed capital investment is in the range of some of the biggest spending Western European countries. Now, this is data from 1970, but a more recent snapshot might show a similar picture, would show, in fact, a similar picture. While Japan is no longer the lowest spending country in the OECD, it still is below the OECD average, and its level of public fixed capital investment is one of the highest in the world. What this indicates is that a lot of this public fixed capital investment was being financed by an off-budget mechanism, namely PhILP. But I should also add that it understates, really, the effect of PhILP, because a lot of PhILP's investments and loans are not captured by this public fixed capital investment variable. Now let me discuss PhIL reform. What I've discussed to this point really seems that with PhIL, the Japanese government had found some kind of magical fiscal silver bullet. But the government's use of PhIL to manage its public finances actually contained contradictions. Now I want to discuss some of the problems with PhIL that emerged and the government's efforts to reform the PhIL system. And here are the three problems I want to draw your attention to. The first are management problems. Okay. While PhIL can be used to finance Japan's public investments, PhIL funds are fundamentally different than tax revenues, as I've emphasized before. They have to be returned to the system. For a number of reasons, though, considerations of financial risk and the soundness of investments became subordinated to the government's other goals, specifically keeping budget spending low and also paying for the LDP's pork barrel spending. Caught between these priorities, the quality of PhIL loans and investments declined, bad loans accumulated, and in some cases, PhIL-financed projects failed, which in turn attracted growing media and political criticism of the system. A related point is that PhIL ironically became a drain on resources. As PhIL projects went bad, they had to be covered with tax revenues. A third problem with the PhIL system was the growth of the PhIL system. And again, this is very ironic. The growth of the PhIL system actually made PhIL a very convenient and useful tool for the government, right? A source of public finance kept on pouring into the government's coffers. But ironically, this growth engendered a political backlash. Specifically, private financial institutions argued that the PhIL system or various component parts of it competed with them for business with unfair advantages. Private banks had long opposed the postal savings system, which continued to grow through the 1990s, and the government financial institutions also competed with the banks for lending business. The private financial institutions argued that the PhIL system should be reduced, and the government should reduce its role in allocating finance. Now, these arguments had long been made by the Japan Bankers Association and others, but they began to find some degree of political traction in the 1990s among two sets of reformers. One were reformers pushing for financial liberalization. You have probably all heard about Hashimoto's Big Bang financial liberalization plans. Many reformers argued that this kind of a system was really anathema to financial liberalization because of what it represented was the government playing a very large and direct role in choosing the allocation of finance. A second group of reformers mobilized around the large, sprawling apparatus that had developed around PhIL, particularly the large number of PhIL agencies, the public corporations and the government financial institutions that used PhIL funds, such as the Road Corporation and so forth. They argued that the state apparatus needed to be trimmed back and the number of these FILP agencies should be reduced. So all of these really made FILP to some extent a political liability for the ruling party and helped push FILP reform onto the political agenda. Now let me talk about some of the specifics of reform. Okay, this is a somewhat complicated figure here, but I'll explain it in just a second. The Hashimoto reform is the first big reform, and that focused on breaking up the FILP system and also exposing it to greater market competition. At least that was the rationale. Now let me start with breaking up the system. The first major element was to break off postal savings and the pension system from FILP. Under the old system, the funds from both were mandated by law to be transferred into the FILP system. Reformers had criticized that this feature of the FILP system because they believed that the funds that flowed into FILP, regardless of whether they were not or they were needed or not, supply, in their opinion, determined usage. Well, it should be the other way around, with the government determining the exact amount of funds that it needed and then going out and raising those funds. Another rationale was that pension funds could earn higher returns than the FILP system paid. Breaking off postal savings and pension reserves required creating a new mechanism for raising funds for the FILP system, and the new mechanism the government hit upon was using bonds. Two types of bonds are now used to raise funds for the FILP system. There's the FILP agency bond and FILP bonds. The terminology is a little confusing there. FILP agency bonds are issued directly by each of those individual FILP agencies, such as the Road Corporation. And the notion was that by being forced to raise their own funds on the private market, FILP agencies would be exposed to greater market scrutiny, creating incentives for sound management. Now, FILP bonds, by contrast, are issued by the Japanese government and have a government guarantee, which keeps interest rates low. The funds raised by the FILP bonds are then, as under the old system, allocated by the Ministry of Finance under the FILP plan. Now, ultimately, this new financing scheme did not really succeed in introducing greater market pressure. First, the government was not mandated to rely on FILP agency bonds. The government was free to continue to issue FILP bonds, which were essentially the same as Japanese government bonds. But more fundamentally, though, FILP agency bonds ended up with an implicit government guarantee, making them not that different from the FILP bonds. Initially, the government wanted to create bankruptcy proceedings for the FILP agencies. Without the possibility of going bankrupt, reformers argued that reform would have little meaning. But as the government pushed ahead with these reforms, the bond markets increasingly became uneasy and shunned those bonds. But the entire notion of the policy finance system in the first place was to provide low-cost capital, right, which this clearly wasn't happening. So in the end, the government retreated from reform, and FILP agency bonds now at least have an implicit government guarantee. There are some other outstanding issues left by FILP reform. While postal savings was broken off from the FILP system, what to do with postal savings was essentially put off to another day. The entire post office was restructured into something called Japan Post, but it remained fully public. So essentially, postal savings funds remained completely under public control still. Another issue was that the funds from postal savings as well as pension reserves could also make their way back into the existing FILP system. They could be used to purchase FILP agency bonds, which you can see indicated by the top arrow, financing FILP agencies, or they could also be used to purchase FILP bonds, which that would then be transferred into this fiscal investment loan program and then transferred into the FILP system. So in other words, it opened up another sort of backdoor channel to allow the funds to be transferred back into the FILP system. Now, the Koizumi reforms, I'll talk briefly about, dealt with some of these outstanding issues. Koizumi focused on shrinking the size of the FILP plan, the overall size of the FILP plan, and also breaking up a lot of the FILP agencies. And one of his landmark pieces of legislation or reforms was to break up the Road Corporation. He also restructured many of the government financial institutions as well. And he also, as everyone probably knows, privatized the post office, including postal savings. So what to do with postal savings was to get it out of government control. Now, we're in the middle of the long transition process to postal privatization. Since the new government has come to power in 2009, it's unclear what will actually happen with postal privatization. But, you know, at that point in time, Koizumi was successful in privatizing, or at least passing legislation that would privatize postal savings in the entire post office. Okay, now let me conclude with some observations about some of the outstanding issues that I think previous reforms have not adequately dealt with and some policy directions that the government might consider for the future. I'll start with some of the problems. The first is size. There's no doubt that post-Hashimoto governments have reduced the size of FILP. But overall, the size of the FILP plan and the entire FILP system continues to be quite large. FILP agency bonds also, to some extent, really hide the true size of FILP because now they're actually excluded from the FILP plan, although clearly they're part of a larger FILP system. So a lot of these numbers that you hear about the decreases in the size of FILP are partly an accounting issue. Postal savings continues to be a very large system. And in a way, FILP reform ironically has increased the role of government in allocating capital, since the government has maintained control over postal savings, yet also created a new mechanism to finance FILP. Now, I don't want to suggest that the FILP system is inherently bad, and I don't believe it is. I think it can serve a useful role. But there should be some concern that FILP and postal savings might continue to crowd out private finance. It's not clear to me that any of the reforms that have happened to date have really been based on a bottom-up rethinking of what FILP should be used for and what it shouldn't be used for. I think only after this happens can the government really determine what the appropriate size of FILP should be. The second issue, outstanding issue, a closely related one, is the management of FILP. Under the LDP, increased politicization led to a growing irrationality of FILP investments. Again, I don't want to suggest that there's no need for FILP or that FILP is inherently bad. To the contrary, the whole notion of policy finance is partly based on the idea that it can help overcome market failures and provide useful public goods. And as economists who have studied FILP have noted, during its early years, FILP investments did in fact support economic growth by providing useful infrastructure and so forth. Interestingly, during Obama's campaign, he proposed an infrastructure bank to promote economic growth. And last week, I had discussions with someone at the Brookings Institution who had worked in the Clinton administration, and he argued this is exactly what the U.S. needed at this point in time. In the case of Japan, though, they've already had FILP, which has partly functioned as an infrastructure bank. But whether FILP investments and lending promote the public good or just narrow economic interests at the expense of the larger economy is heavily contingent on how FILP is managed. In this regard, I don't think there have been too many fundamental changes, including after the DPJ has taken power. The DPJ continues to use FILP, and there are clear indications that it will continue to do so. This is pretty clear in the government's new growth strategy plan that was issued by the National Policy Unit recently. One encouraging sign, though, is the new policy-making bodies the DPJ has created. The National Policy Unit sets broad fiscal and economic policy, while the Government Revitalization Unit, or GRU, reviews specific spending decisions. According to what I've heard, though, the NPU and GRU, the National Policy Unit, and the Government Revitalization Unit have not been interested in the management of FILP, although this could potentially change in the future. A third problem is that of weakening fiscal discipline. Again, this is very ironic since FILP was initially created as a tool to maintain fiscal discipline and keep budget spending low. While no longer part of FILP, the postal savings system has really become a crutch that the government has used to help finance its deficits. Access to these funds has shielded the government to some extent from bond market signals and arguably delayed a reckoning with its own fiscal problems. FILP has also financed a great deal of local government debt, which really has been a way for the government to defer dealing with its larger deficit problems. Okay, now let me move to policy recommendations. There are three. The first is clarifying priorities, and this is fairly obvious, but there really needs to be a larger discussion about priorities, what's appropriate for FILP and what's not appropriate for FILP. The FILP system has evolved in a very ad hoc manner. Since the funds were already there, the government dispersed them pretty liberally without much systematic thought. As one official mentioned to me who ran the system in the 1970s, we used the FILP funds because they were there. As a result, FILP has really been put to a mind-boggling array of uses, from building resorts to bridges to hospitals and so forth. While determining which of these are wasteful or not is a useful exercise, the government really needs a broader discussion of what areas could benefit from policy finance as a framework for managing the Philip system. A second policy recommendation that's closely related is insulating decision-making from political pressure. The government needs to make sure that decisions are made in such a way to promote broad interests over narrow ones. The management of Philip has clearly strayed from this principle. Beyond broad goals, the government has to make sure that the execution of projects are insulated from political influence. While there may be some agreement about using Philip, for example, to improve, let's say, rail infrastructure, if the rail infrastructure that's actually built goes to the areas with powerful political forces, rather than where investment is needed, it could potentially just be wasteful spending. Now, what concretely can be done? First and foremost, I think that the cabinet needs to centralize control over Philp spending. Right now, the DPJ has not really done that great a job with Philp. It's focused much more on the budget, and the management of Philp proceeds as it has in the past. But the functions of the National Policy Unit and the Government Revitalization Unit can be expanded to assert greater control over Philp. The NPU can provide clear instructions for how Philp should be managed. Priorities should be set at the national level, and discretion of the individual ministries should be reduced. The government could also go further by creating an independent commission within the NPU for prioritizing areas for public investment. The Government Revitalization Unit can also help the government review Philp finance projects and, where appropriate, eliminate wasteful ones. A third policy recommendation is to expand loan guarantees. Philp is nearly completely what's called a direct lending system. The government directly invests and lends by drawing on financial resources that it directly controls. I think Japan might benefit by considering use of a different kind of mechanism, namely loan guarantees. The government could provide direct subsidies from the budget and use private financial institutions for the lending. Why? What's the rationale or advantage of this kind of approach? First, it would get rid of the need for the Philp agencies. This would reduce the use of Philp agencies as a spot to place retired bureaucrats, the so-called amakudari problem. It would also reduce the pressure politicians could put directly on the Philp system. Politicians often put pressure directly on Philp agencies. With private banks taking over their role, the scope for such influence would really be eliminated. Second, it would reduce scope for cross-subsidies within the Philp agencies. Part of the problem with the Philp agencies is that some of the projects or programs are profitable while others lose money. The profitable ones can subsidize the loss-making ones. If this is what the government wants to do and is fully aware of it, perhaps that's acceptable. But the current system makes it hard to keep track of who is subsidizing whom and whether it makes policy sense. Also, there's the real danger of having bad loans accumulate in the Philp system without a clear accounting of the losses. To avoid such problems requires very close and onerous monitoring. Using loan guarantees would increase transparency and reduce monitoring costs. Okay, now let me conclude by discussing some of the factors that I see inhibiting Philp reform. There are three problems in particular, all well known: Japan's high level of public debt, its large budget deficits, and its chronic lack of tax revenue. Now let me explain how these matter to Philp reform. I believe that the government's really been reluctant to cede control over the financial resources that it controls because its budgetary situation is so dire. For example, take postal savings. Ceding control will ultimately mean getting rid of a tool that it uses to absorb Japanese government bonds. This is hugely problematic for the government given its reliance on deficit financing. As you may have heard, for the first time since World War II, bond issues now are exceeding tax revenues in Japan. Also, the lack of tax revenue and high deficits are conditions that increase the government's temptation to keep on using Philp to avoid further straining the budget. As long as the budget situation remains so dire, the government will almost certainly continue to rely on Philp. So in sum, some combination of raising taxes, lowering deficits, and reducing its overall stock of public debt, a worthy and important goal in and of itself, will also help facilitate, I believe, reforming the Philp system. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Professor Park. It was a very comprehensive overview, and I look forward to hearing the thoughts of our attendees today. I'd like to open up just with a brief question, and that has to do with postal savings. Obviously, that's a very controversial issue. The fate of the bill is unclear at this point. What are your thoughts, both on the current debate on postal reform, and also whether that will have any impact on the size issue of PHILP that you described?
With the issue of postal reform, as most of you probably know, the new government, under pressure from a smaller coalition partner, has drafted legislation to undo some of the reforms that were pushed through by Koizumi that might effectively end privatization. The contents of the bill, the draft bill, stipulate that there will be a limit on the percentage of shares that can be sold by the government to the public. Right now, the government controls Postal Japan Post, but the notion was that they would sell off the shares completely and cede complete government control. But the new legislation or draft stipulates that they can only sell up to one-third of the shares. So that's a baseline. Also importantly, the legislation includes provisions that would allow Japan Post, specifically postal savings as well as the postal insurance program, to increase the range of financial products that it offers. So this in particular, I think, is a step backward from the Koizumi reforms. Whether or not Japan Post is private or to what extent it's private is an important issue in and of itself. But I think from the bank's perspective and also from a sort of larger economic perspective, one of the bigger concerns is how big is Japan Post and is it competing with private financial banks? So this provision that would allow Japan Post and also the postal insurance system to even offer and expand additional financial products, I think, is potentially threatening to the private financial institutions. Now, whether or not postal privatization will be stopped or not, I think, remains an open question. Now that the DPJ doesn't have control of the upper house, I think it'll be much more difficult for it to pass. So we'll have to see on that one. Now, the connection between postal reform and PHILP, postal funds are used to finance PHILP bonds. But given the fact that these PHILP bonds and PHILP agency bonds that now finance the PHILP system have, in some cases, a direct or at least an implicit guarantee, I don't think really that the size of PHILP will be limited by the fact that postal savings has been broken off, and or even in the future, if the postal savings is privatized, I don't think that'll inhibit the ability of the government to raise funds for the fiscal investment loan program. So I don't see a direct connection between postal reform and the future size of the PHILP system.
Thank you. We'll open it up for questions. I would ask you to please identify yourself and your affiliation and try to be as brief as possible so that we can include as many of you as we can. Please.
Thank you very much. My name is Yoneyama from Mitsui and the company Washington, D.C. office. Your third recommendation has something to do with PPP or PFI type of public and private partnership. I think UK is way ahead introducing PPP PFI system. And I want to know your impression how successful the model is. And then in Japan, PPP is used for Haneda Airport expansion type of logistics base or logistics center expansion program. I think that makes good sense. But also PPP is used in Japan for school management system. The number of children is declining, and I don't know if it's effective in terms of the return on investment. And for that area, whether the private investment is effective or not. So if you have any suggestion about the good application and not necessarily good application for PFI, that's another question. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned PFI because what I was talking about is a little bit different. I was thinking about lending rather than public investment. But the point about PFIs is one that's well taken. I think that Japan could also benefit not just from loan guarantees, but also PFI. An example of loan guarantees is in the U.S., something called the Federal Credit Program. And it functions along the lines of what I was suggesting. Not Freddie and Fannie, by the way, so I don't think that would necessarily be a good model but at this point. But regarding PFI, Britain, again, has been at the forefront of using PFI. And my understanding, I'm not an expert on the British application of PFI, is that the record has been somewhat mixed. And that while it's reduced the size of public spending, there have been a number of cost overruns. So there's still, to some extent, even when you mobilize the private sector, the issue of monitoring, right, and getting the bids and the contracts right, and having a system for, I guess, probably penalizing contractors that have cost overruns. Now, you mentioned the example of Haneda Airport, and I actually am not familiar with that case, so that's something that I'd like to learn more about. But with the loan guarantees, getting back to the financing rather than the public works side of things, I think that the biggest benefit will actually be political rather than necessarily efficiency, although the two are clearly linked. Because the Philip agencies and these bodies have really formed a large, almost parastate apparatus, very low transparency. They've now implemented rules, accounting rules, where they have to have policy cost analysis now for various lending programs and so forth. But if you look at it, it's actually quite rudimentary and not particularly enlightening when you look at it, and you really don't get a good sense of what's going on inside of these entities. So I think one of the reasons that I suggest this reform is to get rid of those entities. And again, this would have a political effect, I think. So, but thank you for your comments. I'll have to look into this issue of Haneda Airport, and I think PFI is another important thing to consider, a very good policy recommendation.
Ben Goldberg from the State Department. Gene, you had a really fascinating and deep presentation, and I'm almost afraid to ask a question because I'm afraid it'll show how ignorant I am of the whole issue of finance in general, but maybe I can ask a specific question, which maybe is more micro, which is, just to clarify, it seems to me that your points about inefficient management of FILP funds, well, what that basically means in sort of basic English is using money to buy things, to build local projects that are not economically efficient. Is that accurate? Because you read stories all the time about the conference centers that nobody uses in rural Japan, or building airports that aren't used, or other relatively inefficient projects. And I guess the two questions I have about that is FILP, most of those done under the FILP program? So they are off budget. Is that true? And the other question is, if these projects are built using FILP funds, and then they are inefficient to the point that there is no return on them, they're not used, I assume that's what you mean when you're talking about the drain on the budget, because then government tax revenue is used to pay back postal savings and the pension funds for these loans for projects that aren't producing revenue back. Is that accurate?
Okay, that's an extremely important point, so I'm glad you asked that. Let me start with you asked about the inefficiency of the management of the FILP and whether a lot of these public works projects were being financed by a FILP. That's the case, yes. And what happened, and partly, again, the connection with the budget is extremely important. You can finance it via the budget, or you can finance it by a FILP. But if you finance it by a FILP, you got to make sure you get your money back, right? If you build a bridge, you get tolls, and you can pay back your loan, right? So some of the problem was the fact that a lot of these projects wouldn't be able to generate enough return to pay back their FILP loans. So they should have actually just been financed by the budget. So part of the problem was that within the Ministry of Finance, it's somewhat complicated. The Budget Bureau has tended to be much more powerful than the Financial Bureau, which handles FILP. So when the Budget Bureau has wanted to cut budget expenditures, or in some cases ordered the Financial Bureau to pick up the tab for some of these projects. Right, exactly. Or you should take up some of the cost of that. And this is somewhat of a controversial issue, and whether, to the extent to which it happens now, I'm not sure, but I did a lot of historical interviews and I talked with people, and you know, people at the Ministry of Finance aren't proud of that this happened, right? So, you know, that's one of the problems. But what happened in the 1980s was when Nakasone was pursuing fiscal consolidation, and they made a real push to limit the growth of the budget. There were zero growth ceilings on the budget and so forth. You know, ironically, it was done partly on the back of FILP, which exacerbated the problem. Again, items got shifted from the budget onto FILP, in some cases without enough consideration about the long-term financial costs of doing that. So in the 1980s, what you saw is these public investment going up, but the budget share actually going to public works projects actually decreasing. So what happened during this time period was that these various public works projects got pushed onto FILP increasingly, and partly it was being driven by the fact that the funds were there. You know, FILP during the 1980s and through the 1990s was growing very tremendously. Postal savings deposits were increasing. The pension system was still maturing, so there were a lot more people paying into the system than paying out in benefits. So there was that logic as well. Now, you really hit on an important issue, which is what's going to happen if these projects can't pay back their FILP loans. And in many cases, what happened is that the government ended up having to pick up the tab. But in some cases, the costs have been hidden by this cross-subsidy process that I was discussing earlier. For example, the former Development Bank of Japan has many profitable lines of business. And what it can do is if it loses money on another project, it can subsidize those, right? But I think that's somewhat problematic because it's not clear that, you know, that makes sense to cross-subsidize one project to another. And it's just less transparent, and I think that's the advantage of using the budget. You know, do you want to follow up?
Nick, if I could just follow up for one question. But I guess despite FILP, you still have a Japanese budget deficit that is massive.
Right.
And so I guess I'm wondering, are those bad decisions from the 70s and 80s contributing in what you think is a major way to the current deficit now? In other words, now the government has to use budgets to pay off some of the tab from the previous FILP projects that aren't paying back the money. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, no, that absolutely makes sense. My answer is yes. And you can see now it's now the subsidies from – while it's not part of the FILP plan officially, some of these government corporations get money from FILP, but they also get money directly from the budget. So the portion coming from the budget is increasing and is now quite large. Another issue is local government debts. And that is, I think, a very complicated political issue because the FILP system now holds a lot of local government debt. Now, whether that's a bad loan or not, whether to classify it as a bad loan or not is kind of a conceptual issue, but it's clear, I think, that a lot of local governments do not have the fiscal capacity to pay back the debt that they've been accumulating. And interestingly, just today, I was looking at some propositions from Shizuka Kamei, and he actually kind of wants to exacerbate this problem a little bit by having postal savings and postal insurance finance more local government debt. But I think that that just really defers the problem. So I think that's something to look out for in the future. It's a very tricky issue.
I'm Keiichiro Nakazawa from Japan International Cooperation Agency, one of the FILP agency you call. I think it's a little bit misleading you to say that this FILP budget is off budget. It's on budget. You know, it needs to be approved by the parliament, as is the case of the general budget. It's just not general budget. It's not off budget. It's on budget. And you know, it seems to me that many discussions, but one of the reasons of the expansion of this so-called second budget, I think, was, you know, in 1980s and probably early 1990s, there was a trade friction between the U.S. and Japan. Now you have it with China. And at that time, your government said the same thing as you say to China now. That is, to stimulate domestic demand to Japan. And one of the reasons that, you know, this expansion happened, I mean, the FILP budget expansion happened, was maybe because of, you know, such kind of, you know, demand from external countries. So that's my comment. And I have one question. You know, the statistics which you showed us at the beginning, comparison, you know, among different countries about the outstanding amount of investment and loan to GDP ratio. You have the same figures for like China, Korea, and other Asian countries. I think saving culture really matters. US spend too much and Asians spend too less. That might be one of the reasons of the expansion of this type of budget.
Thanks for your comments. About the issue about whether to call FILP off budget or on budget, I think is kind of a semantic one. I mean, it's clearly a different mechanism. So I think that you can conceptually make that distinction between a tax-based or social insurance-based budget and the FILP system. In all the OECD statistics, FILP is not considered budgetary spending. They use the UN's accounting practices. Regarding the second issue about stimulating demand and pressure from external countries, certainly I think that's the case. The U.S. has put pressure on Japan to stimulate its economy at various points in time. But while that's the case, the government didn't have to necessarily use the FILP system to stimulate the economy and increase aggregate demand. In fact, I'm not even sure that using FILP really stimulates aggregate demand. It's not the same as fiscal stimulus. It's not the same as deficit financing. Just to some extent, the decision to use FILP expand it to stimulate economic growth in the face of foreign pressure, U.S. pressure in particular, I see the pressure being there, but I don't see necessarily that leading to a decision about using FILP per se rather than the budget to stimulate the economy. And for the issue about data, I do not have data for China or South Korea. This data is extremely difficult to come by because these policy finance systems, while budgets are well studied and there's some accounting principles about how to compare budgets across different national contexts, none of that exists for policy finance. Right? Each country's policy finance, the U.S.'s and Japan's, are very different in their configuration. So unfortunately, there are real data limitations. Your point about having high savings, the key to making FILP work was that Japan had a very high savings rate. I don't think it would have worked had that not been the case. But the issue is really whether or not the private sector or the public sector mediates those savings. So in the case of Japan, there was clearly a system that evolved. I think they didn't realize, the planners who invented the system in the 40s and the 50s imagined that actually the FILP system would ever become so large. But I think part of the problematic aspect of FILP was that it just expanded so rapidly and became such a large presence in the economy. I know that South Korea has a system that was actually modeled on the FILP system based in the 1970s. My understanding is that as a size, it's smaller. But again, I don't have very good comparative data, so that's a good question.
Hi, my name is Tomo, and I'm a medical doctor from Japan, and I'm studying public health at Hopkins right now. So I'm sort of lay people in person in this area. But I just wonder the price efficiency on this system comparing to the official budget. So based on my experience, the national hospitals purchases the same medical device in the 3 times higher price than the private hospitals. So I just wonder this type of flip system may reduce the expenditure on for the same product or not. Your regulation curve made Japan really a negative outlier. And I also remembered the Preston curve, that is a health expense and health outcome. Then most of the East Asian countries like China, Taiwan, Korea, and Japan is below the regulation curve, while U.S. is a positive outlier, spending so much money and having a less health outcome. So I just wonder, this type of system may create certain price efficiency by not going through such a governmental procedure like fixed budget, but just letting people to make a flexible financing or not.
So you think that FILP might reduce efficiency?
Okay, for the same product, right, reduce price?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that some of that's certainly gone on. I mean, you've probably all heard about bid rigging, which has been a big problem in Japan on public works projects, right? And a lot of these public works projects were being financed by the FILP system. But the same thing could happen, though, if the projects were financed by the budget. as well, right? You can still have bid rigging. So really the issue about efficiency has to be addressed at that kind of micro-institutional level, I think. So that's a real concern. Does that address your question completely?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Others? Sure. Lisa Gomi with Asia Policy Point. I was wondering, given that there's so many issues with cross-subsidizing and hiding some expenditures, and the fact that because it's not tax-based that these expenditures need to be returned, I was wondering if you could clarify more what kind of accountability can be implemented. You did mention clarifying priorities, but I guess I was wondering more how these priorities could be enforced.
What could be enforced? What was the last part? I'm sorry.
The priorities that you mentioned. You said that one thing that needed to be done was to clarify priorities for the expenditures of FILP, and I was wondering if you could clarify how you would, I guess, in a magical, in an ideal world, how you would implement the enforcement of these priorities.
I think with the issue of priorities, the system evolved because the funds were there. And ministries, for example, they saw the pot of funds increasing. They would invent their own FILP agency to use those funds, and then they would use those funds for all kinds of different policies. Right? That's historically how the system evolved. Well, I think that some of the FILP reforms have kind of tried to trim out some of the irrationality of the system and get rid of the waste, and they've made, I think, significant improvements in that regard. No one has really started with a kind of set of principles about how FILP should be used and what it should be used for, what kinds of market failures are out there, what types of public goods it should be providing. So what I was getting about with this priorities notion is really kind of starting over in a way. Because most of the reforms, while they've attempted to shrink the overall size of FILP, they really haven't kind of gone in with the scalpel and said, you know what, this entire operation really doesn't make sense. So I think there needs to be kind of some kind of guideline for each spending ministry to be able to say, you know what, I can propose this kind of project or not. And how would it be enforced? It has to come from the top. Because what happens with the FILP system is all these decisions about what kind of FILP agency to create, what kind of program to finance, this was kind of bureaucratic initiative that happened within individual ministries. And I think that the sort of direction of influence needs to be reversed. The cabinet and the executive need to come up with principles about, you know, what priorities should be used, and then specifically what kind of projects or policies fit within those priorities, and then essentially order or have the ministries execute them. And so it's really been kind of reversed, and you need, I think, what needs to happen to implement it is really to reverse the policy process, policymaking process to some extent, I think. And, you know, you see this problem being debated now about all policies, not just about FILP with the budget, right? Now they've created this national policy unit specifically to empower the executive, right, to have more top-down decision-making. You know, the only problem that I have with that is that they've really kind of ignored FILP. They've been focused much more on the budget. So, I mean, I think if they move more in the direction that they are with trying to assert greater control over the formal budget, they could make a lot of progress. So there are existing institutions. They just need to expand, I think, their capabilities and control FILP better. Yes?
From what I've heard about FILP, there seems to be a lot of pork barreling that is done through the FILP budget. And so it seems like there's not that much political motivation to reform FILP or to make it more accountable and efficient. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, I guess, what you thought could address that or effectively stop that
There hasn't been much motivation to reform FILP. Yes, I think that's true, and I think part of it, again, goes back. No one wants to touch FILP because it's very convenient in a sort of context of budget scarcity. People don't want to, they realize they can't have access to budget funds, so you know, FILP becomes very convenient, and I think that's part of the fundamental problem. There has been some improvement in accountability. As I mentioned before, there have been attempts to have better financial accounting from the FILP agencies. I still think there's a long way to go in that regard. And I think there's also been a recognition within the government that bad accounting and bad practices end up hurting the Ministry of Finance because they get left holding the bag, holding the tab, essentially. So I think there's also been kind of incremental learning within the Ministry of Finance, which has prevented from, you know, more kind of egregious financial practices. I'm not sure if that addresses your question.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much, Dr. Park. My name is Randy Yoshimura from Sumitomo. Now that we're almost 1 year after the regime change from LDP to DPJ, and during the LDP years, I think it was sort of like the LDP business model, if you will, to be very close with the bureaucrats and make pork barrel, you know, do pork barrel projects, and then let the bureaucracy make these public corporations, so they could amakudaru these people. Now with DPJ in power, not much power, but still in office. Do you think that will change? That tendency will change? Will the DPJ business model, or is it pretty much the same?
This is a broad topic, and I think that it's kind of too early to say. I mean, I think the DPJ has clearly come in thinking that they're going to change the relationship between the LDP and the bureaucracy. They've made a lot of concrete changes as well, including creating this National Policy Unit and the Government Revitalization Unit and so forth. And all of this is very potentially promising. Also, there have been other initiatives where LDP diet members, backbenchers, DPJ backbench diet members are not allowed to contact bureaucrats directly without creating some kind of log of their interaction. And, that's, I think, is pretty significant. Also, lobbyists now cannot lobby directly to bureaucrats. They have to go through the party apparatus. I think that's also changing the nature of the relationship. But why I say I don't think we know quite yet is that the party's way of filtering demands from its constituents and the public into the policy system, I don't think really is that satisfactory, or they haven't kind of come up with a good model. Let me just give you one example. One model was the Yamba Dam project and the Jigyo Shiwake, right, the project review. All these projects were identified as being wasteful, and they were going to cut them out. What happened is that in many cases, a lot of the communities that were actually supportive of these projects and benefited and lobbied and said, you know what, we should keep these projects alive. So there needs to be some way for them to make top-down decision-making, but also to receive input from local communities and interest groups and so forth. And they haven't really kind of created the machinery yet, I think, and it's a work in progress. The DPJ has now created its policy research council, right, along the lines as existed before, but Ozawa had essentially gotten rid of the policy research council because he thought it would lead to too much backbencher input, essentially, in the policymaking process. So we'll have to see what happens with this new policy research council. With the LDP, that was the important interface, right, between various interests, and also part of the point where LDP and bureaucrats form these iron triangles to some extent. But there needs to be, I think, a balance between having top-down decision-making and allowing input, I think, political input. So.
Could I throw in a classic two-finger Washington phrase? Getting that back down to Philip, just to clarify, earlier you said that in your presentation that the DPJ is not really necessarily interested in taking on PHILP, either in the National Policy Unit or the Government Revitalization Unit. But you suggested in your recommendation that ultimately that type of centralized control is the solution. Now, obviously, it's too early to tell, but that suggests to me, given the fluidity structurally right now, that perhaps there's room for skepticism on the pace of reform, and I just wonder if you could comment on that.
Okay, I think the reason that they have moved slowly on PHILP, I mean, there's probably a good reason to be skeptical, but sort of more pragmatically, so much of their domestic agenda was about freeing up budgetary funds, to push through these expensive programs, the child allowance and so forth. So I think that really kind of explains the timing of it and why they focus so much, why the Jigyo Shiwake, for example, focused so much on the budget rather than FILP. FILP wasn't seen as a potential source of big savings necessarily for the DPJ in implementing its new policy directions. So maybe that's a reason to be a little less skeptical. But more fundamentally, though, I think that the problem is that they might actually go slowly on FILP reform, largely because of, again, this issue, this chronic issue of the scarcity of public funds, right? So they may be reluctant to really kind of take a scalpel to the entire FILP system and rework it, especially, loan guarantees, for example. That's something that would actually require more direct subsidies from the budget, and there aren't those budget resources available. So that would sort of argue in favor of actually being skeptical that the DPJ would engage in full reform aggressively. So I think there's evidence in both directions right now. So, good question.
Any other? Please.
I'm Tom Oak, Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi UFJ, one of the private sector bank. So directly competes with UB in Chokin, Japan Post. That's a very concern, but as you suggested, the Japan Post issue is not really for the major banks issue, but smaller banks issue. So it's really critical. I think that this Japan Post issue is similar to GSE's Fannie Freddie discussions and so-called implicit guarantee by the government. So it's really fundamental issue. So it's really big issue. Obviously, that the smaller banks cannot compete if there is an implicit guarantee of the Japan Post. And obviously, many Japanese citizens just simply think, well, the Japan Post is safe. But there's only an implicit guarantee. So it's very interesting. But similarly, really fundamental question you raised today is whether which decision is appropriate for appropriate to avoid wasteful spending is whether the government, clever government people decides, or the market mechanism, the private sector, based on the truly economic analysis, based on the which project, which infrastructure investment is truly producing money or return on investments. And it's really important, and not just Japan, but all the decision for the United States or European nations now faces. So I don't really have a clear answer for that, but your suggestion of centralized decision is, I think, makes sense. Because at least before, in the last decades, the Japan took basically decision is made by each ministry, as you said, and each ministry is only thinking about each ministry's interest and backed up by some politicians. That's the LDP system, LDP business model that Randy says. So as far as that caused a lot of wasteful spending, perhaps the Japan should take a little different approach. And that's one idea is centralized system, I think. But centralized system, again, whatever the National Planning Bureau or whatever, whether those bureau makes the right decision or not is different story. And again, there's no those new bureaus mostly perhaps consisted of bureaucrats, some chosen from the other ministries, and those bureaucrats from each ministry is, say, spend a few years in National Planning Bureau and then return to the ministry. It's different from the U.S. system. So they never forget about each ministry's interest. So if that's the case, perhaps not much change, even if the decision is centralized. But in U.S., like U.S. system, if you move, well, there's some mixture, but if you move to National Planning Bureau, and then you must spend your whole life there. Or you may, if you retire, you may seek the job somewhere else. If that's the case, it may be different. And also, some private sector people move to that agency and then makes a really, truly based on the market mechanism, truly economic efficiency decision. That may be different. So I think that that's the way how to, after centralized decision system is made, how it works really matters. And the still infrastructure investment perhaps needs some political or the kind of a national interest viewpoint, not just based on the economics or efficiency or return on investment. So again, always it's not so easy solution, but at least I would rather agree to you that try the different decision system and run a couple of years and how it gets support or how the each return on investment is appropriate or not. So I appreciate your suggestion.
Thanks for those comments, and I'm glad you brought up the point about the implicit guarantee with Japan Post. I mean, in a way, Japan, the postal savings system wasn't supposed to ever be as large as it is now, right? They got rid of some of the tax benefits on interest earned from the postal savings account. A lot of high interest kind of CD type of investments in postal savings matured in 2000, and there was supposedly going to be this Y2K problem with money flowing instantly out of postal savings as these CD interest rates matured. And that never happened because of the financial crisis that was going on. And because of the financial crisis, there was a flight to safety. So throughout the 90s and beyond 2000, while postal savings was supposed to shrink of its own accord, it actually grew. So this notion of the implicit guarantee is really, I think, behind that phenomenon. So I'm glad you pointed that out. And the issue about wasteful spending, there's that issue, and there's also how you finance the spending. My own view is that if a government can make wasteful spending choices, but if they're going to do it, I actually think it's better to have wasteful spending financed from the budget rather than through FILP, because FILP creates all kinds of accounting and transparency problems. Because whether a project won't earn its return is something that happens many years down the road. So there's a real moral hazard problem to that. But if it comes straight from the budget, there's greater transparency, and you don't have to worry about the project paying back a loan. With your suggestion about centralizing the staff, you make a point about how when people get seconded from other ministries, they might still be loyal to their home ministry. I think that's a real problem. We actually had the good fortune of being able to meet with people from the National Policy Unit last week. It was very interesting. And currently we understand they have about 32 staff. I think the Ministry of Finance has 2 staff, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has 1 staff, and so forth. But it seems heavily staffed by, again, these people that come from other ministries. What struck me was a number of things. First of all, that 32 is still a small number, especially if it's going to be this, the brains of the government to some extent in terms of economic policy. I asked this question directly, which is, will they ever move to a different model of having their own permanent staff rather than borrowing staff? And they said that it may happen. Right now, things will change if they pass the legislation that will make these formal government bureaus, but who knows whether that'll happen now since they don't have a majority in the upper house. But I think your suggestions about creating a permanent staff, having more private sector staff as well, and I think also just increasing the capability of it, a larger staff as well, are all very good suggestions. So I appreciate those comments.
Time for maybe one more question.
All right, well, if there are no other questions, just want to say that thank you, Professor Park. And Professor Park has one more obligation as a Japan Policy Fellow, and that's to elaborate on these themes in an essay, which we'll disseminate via our newsletter in the next few weeks. So please look for that. And please join me in thanking Professor Park for a wonderful presentation.
Thanks for listening. For more, please visit csis.org.